Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Williams. Join me as we explore the life and legacy of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur and discuss a wide range of military history topics from the American Civil War to the Korean War. During World War II, thousands of British cadets learned to fly at six civilian training schools across the southern United States. The first and largest of the schools was in Terrell, Texas. More than 2,200 Royal Air Force and United States Army Air Corps cadets earned their wings at the number one British flying training school in Terrell between 1941 and 1945. To tell us more about this flying school in Terrell, we are joined by Tom Killebrew, author of The Royal Air Force in Texas, Training British Pilots in Terrell During World War II. Welcome, sir, and thank you for joining us today.
Amanda, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Start us off with some background information. What is going on in Europe during the early part of World War II, and why did the British need to locate flying schools out of the country?
The European War begins in early September 1939 with the German invasion of Poland and the British and French declarations of war. In spite of previous rearmament programs, the British Royal Air Force is unprepared for war. Everything is in short supply. Training command has to vie with other Royal Air Force departments for very limited resources. There are also serious drawbacks to flight training in Britain during wartime. These include the limited size of the country, an urgent need for airfield and support facilities for operational squadrons, the often abysmal British weather, and the very real possibility of enemy attack.
So the British have an empire. Why not locate training schools in those areas? Why do they look to the United States?
Well, the British will establish flight schools in many Commonwealth countries, because even before the beginning of the war, British Air Ministry officials recognized the limitations of flight training in Britain during wartime. They contacted other Commonwealth governments about establishing flight training schools. These lengthy and complex conversations resulted in the Empire Air Training Scheme. Under this scheme, Canada became the key to British overseas training, where the plan was known as the Commonwealth Air Training Plan. But training in Commonwealth countries also had drawbacks. Some locations were literally on the other side of the world. Some had remote interior locations, supply problems, extremes of elevation and weather, all of which limited the air training programs. The British naturally looked to the United States for possible assistance. The highly industrialized United States offered a location close to Canada and Britain and would be a valuable source of materials such as aircraft, engines, fuel, and strategic raw materials. Also, the American president, Franklin Roosevelt, was determined to aid Britain, which now stood alone against Nazi Germany.
Can you walk us through how the number one British flying training school was set up in Terrell?
The British flying training schools are very unique among the various flight training programs during World War II. These were purpose-built schools. They will be constructed, owned, and operated by established American civilian flight school operators. School personnel, flight instructors, ground school instructors, maintenance personnel, and even the clerical staff will all be civilians. The Terrell School, or number one BFTS, will be operated by Major William Long of Dallas, Texas. Each school will have a complement of British Royal Air Force personnel acting in a supervisory capacity. The schools will use the standard Royal Air Force flight training syllabus. Training aircraft will be supplied by the U.S. Army Air Forces under Lend-Lease. Also, all training from the first flight through advanced training and graduation will be conducted at these schools, which is vastly different from other training programs.
When I was reading your book, what really struck me was the fact that the United States hosts this training before Pearl Harbor is attacked. And you just mentioned Lend-Lease. So is that how the United States justifies this aid? And how does nominal American neutrality impact the cadets and their training prior to Pearl Harbor?
U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was the driving force behind aid to Britain after the start of the European War. 4 days before the 1940 presidential election, Roosevelt said, "Our policy is to give all possible material aid to the nations which still resist aggression." Roosevelt knew before that that war was coming, and even with a Democrat-controlled Congress, he literally navigated a political minefield to achieve his rearmament goals and later his efforts to aid Britain. After the start of the war, Roosevelt secured a revision to the Neutrality Act to allow belligerent nations to buy American arms for cash and transport the arms in their own ships. This was known as cash and carry. Later, when the British capital necessary to purchase arms ran low, Roosevelt sponsored the idea of lend-lease. This idea is where American arms would be purchased from manufacturers by the government and loaned to belligerent nations. Winston Churchill described the Lend-Lease Act as the most unsordid act in the history of any nation. Another important, often overlooked factor in a democratic nation is that public opinion had begun to turn in favor of support for Britain after the fall of France, the Battle of Britain, the occupation of Norway, and especially the initiation of German air attacks on London and other British cities. These attacks resulted in considerable damage as well as casualties. All of this was reported by American news outlets. In spite of growing support for Britain, isolationist groups remained strong, and the first British students entered a neutral United States under several restrictions. The first British students entered the country in civilian clothes, and the schools did not offer any live gunnery or bombing practice. After the United States entered the war, the British students wore their regular Royal Air Force units uniforms away from school.
What kinds of aircraft are used at Terrell, and how does the training program for cadets evolve during the war?
At this particular time, the U.S. Army Air Force used a three-stage flight training program. This program consisted of primary, basic, and advanced training. The British system used a two-stage program consisting of elementary and advanced training. In both systems, each stage utilized a different training aircraft. When the Terrell School opened, there was a shortage of advanced trainers in the United States. Therefore, even though the school used the Royal Air Force two-stage flight training syllabus, the Army supplied basic trainers to supplement the shortage of advanced trainers. When the school opened, it received the PT-18 primary trainer, which was always known as the steerman, the Vultee BT-13 basic trainer, and the North American AT-6 advanced trainers. By the fall of 1942, the U.S. had a shortage of basic trainers and an oversupply of advanced trainers. The British were asked if they would trade their basic trainers for advanced trainers. The British, of course, were delighted with this proposal, since this now allowed the aircraft to conform to the British two-stage flight training syllabus. With the removal of the basic trainer, the school employed the steerman, primary trainer, and the AT-6 advanced trainer for the remainder of the school's existence. When the school opened in June 1941, the flight time to train a Royal Air Force pilot had been lowered to 130 hours. British officials added 20 hours of additional training in the American schools to compensate for the lengthy travel time back to Britain after training. Early students at the school graduated from a 20-week course with approximately 150 hours of flight time. The RAF, of course, realized that this training time was a wartime expedient and barely sufficient to train a military pilot. As soon as the critical pilot shortage began to ease, Air Ministry officials increased Royal Air Force flight training to 200 hours, and later in the war, when Britain enjoyed a pilot surplus, flight training was again increased to 220 hours in a 28-week course.
Let's talk about a little bit of the social side of this. What is the relationship like between the British cadets and the American residents of Terrell?
That's a fascinating question, because the story of the British flight school in Terrell is much more than just the story of young men learning to fly airplanes. The British students and local residents formed friendships which lasted throughout the war and continued long after the end of the war. Each weekend, students were guests in local homes. They enjoyed dances, picnics, barbecues, swim parties, and other activities. Many of these were organized for the benefit of the British students. Terrell residents met each arriving train carrying British students, and they assembled at the train station to say goodbye to each class as it departed from Terrell. The city of Terrell placed a bench on Moore Avenue with a sign asking local residents to give a ride to a British student. Students never waited long for a ride. This unique bond between the British students and local residents is one of the most enduring legacies of the British school.
When do American cadets attend the school, and does their curriculum differ from that of the British cadets?
By the summer of 1942, the various Royal Air Force training schemes throughout the world are turning out a surplus of pilots, while the U.S. Army training program is still expanding. Army officials ask if space could be made available in BFTS schools for Army aviation cadets. The British readily agreed to this request, and 18 to 20 American Army flight cadets would train with 7 BFTS courses, starting in November 1942 and going through June 1944. There was no difference in the training of American and British students at Terrell. A little known fact is that Army graduates of the Terrell School were authorized to wear RAF wings over the right uniform pocket, in addition to the standard Army Air Corps pilot wings, which were worn over the left uniform pocket.
So one thing I noticed again about the book is that, unlike the United States, the British don't repatriate their fallen servicemen. And whenever you have kind of a flight training school, there are accidents. And what happens when there are fatalities? What happens when some of these young British men are killed in Texas?
Great Britain, with its long history as a colonial power, their involvement in numerous foreign wars, and a limited land area at home, had long ago decided that servicemen would be buried where they fell. In response to this policy, the Oakland Memorial Park in Terrell set aside a small section of the cemetery for British casualties. By the end of the war, there are 20 graves of British flight students killed during training. The plot contains a small stone monument with a quote from a British poem: "Some corner of a foreign field, which is forever England." Today, the Terrell British Cemetery plot is officially under the supervision of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission that has North American headquarters in Ottawa, Canada.
Tell us about some of the graduates of the school.
Graduates of the Terrell School served on every front in World War II and earned many awards and decorations. The outstanding Terrell graduate is Arthur Aaron, of Course 6, who received the Victoria Cross, comparable to the United States Congressional Medal of Honor. After the war, many Terrell graduates stayed in the Royal Air Force and flew in actions such as the Berlin Airlift, the Malaysian insurrection against communist insurgents, and the Korean War. Several of these rose to high rank during the Cold War. Sir John Gingell, of Course 23, rose to the rank of Air Chief Marshal. That's the same as a four-star general. And after retirement, he became Black Rod in the House of Lords. Others enjoyed successes in various civilian endeavors. Thomas Round became an internationally acclaimed operatic tenor. Alan Branson wrote more than 22 books and articles on aviation subjects, including a well-received series of flight training manuals. British actor Robert Hardy, noted for his portrayal of Winston Churchill and starring role in the PBS series All Creatures Great and Small, trained with Course 27. Ray England, of Course 9, became the chairman of Jaguar Motors in 1972. Henry Madrid, one of several graduates who returned to North Texas to live after the war, served two terms as mayor of Terrell and was instrumental in the formation of the number one BFTS museum.
On May 8, 1945, the war ends in Europe, but the war isn't over in the Pacific at that point. Does training at the school continue? And I guess, when does the school close?
Even with the war in Europe over, it appeared to most that the war in the Pacific would continue well into 1946. The British intended for the school to remain open until April 1946. But the devastation of two atomic bombs in August 1945 and the resulting Japanese surrender brought the war to a sudden conclusion. The school closed on September 10th, 1945, with the graduation of Course 25, the last course to complete training in Terrell. Students in Courses 26 and 27, which did not complete training in Terrell, returned to Britain and were given the option to complete training or leave the service.
Any final thoughts? And could you tell us a little bit about the number one British Flying Training School museum that's in Terrell today?
The museum originally began as a display in the local Terrell Historical Society Museum, located in the old Carnegie Library in Terrell. The number one BFTS museum is now housed in a separate building located at the Terrell Municipal Airport, which is also the original school site, although none of the original school buildings remain, except for two large hangars. The museum includes numerous school photographs, uniform, period artifacts, photos of each class, maps, historical records, and a miniature model of the school as it appeared during the war. The museum also hosts many events and programs throughout the year that honor not only the memory of the British school, but all of the men and women who served during World War II.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for joining us today.
Amanda, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I apologize. I think I've been calling it Terrell instead of Terrell.
No apology necessary. That's fine.
Well, I hope to visit at some point soon.
You would certainly be welcome. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.